morning. This is Reva Winkler with the National Quality Forum. Thank you all very much for joining us today for this call of the Critical Care Work Group for our Pulmonary and Critical Care Endorsement Maintenance Project. This call is a public call, so we do have audience members listening, and we will provide an opportunity for public comment before closing the call. Also, the recording and transcript of this call will be posted on NQF's website. The purpose of our call today is to give this work group an opportunity to review the preliminary reviews of 8 of the measures in the pulmonary and critical care project. There will be 35 measures in all discussed in our in-person meeting in March. That's a large amount of work. And so the preliminary work group calls are intended for the work group members to share their thoughts and concerns and raise issues around the measures in a first pass effort so that we could identify the areas of concern, provide an opportunity for questions and have the developers respond to those questions, and try to be sure that we have all the information needed. The work group members and the ratings and comments in these discussions will be summarized to be presented at the in-person meeting so that we can be very focused in our conversations around the issues and concerns around the measures rather than starting from scratch for each measure with all of the criteria. So that is our goal today, is to look to see what the initial review of the measures have identified, what the concerns are. We will be working off of a document, primarily the spreadsheet that was sent to you all, to the committee members last night. It is a spreadsheet that shows the ratings and comments of the committee on these 8 measures. We are showing that spreadsheet on the webinar for any audience or viewing members. So for committee members, if you want to just look at your own version rather than through the webinar, that's certainly up to you. We'll try and stick to the order of the discussion of the measures and the agenda. And so does anybody on the work group have any questions about what we're going to try and do today? Okay, let's start off with the first measure, and we're going to start off with measure 356, which is blood cultures performed within 24 hours prior to or 24 hours after hospital arrival for patients who were transferred or admitted to the ICU within 24 hours of hospital arrival, and these are patients with diagnosis of pneumonia. Has Dr. Levy joined us? All right, perhaps he's caught up. I think if we look at the spreadsheet, there are 3 of you have submitted your ratings, and in general it looks like you've rated the measure favorably on most of the criteria if we look across importance, high impact, moderate to high opportunity for improvement. This is a measure that has been reported by CMS on Hospital Compare. And it is currently, I'd have to go back, the most recent CMS rate is at 96.9%, though I think there was is this the measure where there was some data showing that at the low end, the bottom fifth really were still struggling for appropriate performance. You all have rated the quantity, quality, and the consistency of the evidence at least high with just a single moderate, and in general feel that it does meet the importance criteria. Does anybody from the work group have any comments about the importance criteria for this measure? Okay, I'm going to assume I've kind of summarized it well. But again, I think this is one where there really is fairly good consistency, not a lot of issues raised or concerns. I will point out that we did receive one implementation comment on this measure. from APIC who felt that that samples of blood and sputum for culture and antigen testing are clear-cut for those with severe community-acquired pneumonia who need critical care. We're not as sure of the use of the timing of such measure for a performance measurement. Kind of a little bit unclear what the intent of their comment was for this particular measure. The developer responded that the measure simply asked whether a blood culture was obtained within 24 hours of hospital arrival for those patients who are admitted to the ICU within 24 hours of hospital arrival, consistent with IDSA ATS 2007 guidelines, and that they had representatives from those societies on their technical panel for that measure. Any comments from the work group in terms of the concerns raised by APIC? No. All right. So in terms of the scientific acceptability of this measure, again, y'all rated it high on reliability and validity and felt that it meets the scientific acceptability criteria. Again, high for usability, high and a couple mediums for feasibility, but again, high to moderate ratings for both usability and feasibility, and all three that submitted ratings indicated you feel that it meets the criteria. So, you know, I hate having a monologue here, but Dr. Almanoff or Dr. Stockwell, Michael, any comments?
It's David Stockwell. I mean, I think you've summarized it well.
Okay, yeah. So is this really as straightforward a measure as it it appears to be?
It was, in my opinion.
Okay. All right, well, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's straightforward also. I mean, it's been around for quite a while.
Okay.
It's reasonably detected, scientifically sound, so
okay.
I'm not sure we have to spend a lot of time on it.
Okay. All right. That's fine, because there are others where we will. Okay. If you all feel comfortable that there really aren't any major issues and concerns with that measure, then let's go ahead and move on.
And that was the blood culture measure?
Yes, correct. Question about it?
Nope. I agree.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll move on to measure 1861, which is the National Healthcare Safety Network ventilator-associated event outcome measure. And I will just say that this is a new measure. Previously, NQF has had endorsed the measure from CDC on ventilator-associated pneumonia. CDC has indicated they are retiring that measure, and this measure is intended to replace it. But this is a new measure submitted to NQF. So, Peter, I believe you were the discussant for this measure. Would you like to kind of summarize and go through the criteria?
You mean 1861? I'm not the discussant of this one.
Oh, do I have the wrong list?
Yeah, I'm the discussant of the
okay.
Of the pediatric ICU one.
Okay. Oh, my list has you on too, but that's okay. In this case,
I'd be glad to give you my.
Okay, that would be super. Because I think this is one where we're going to have some discussion.
I guess I had some concerns about the new criteria, because in the when you kind of read through their description or their analysis, they sort of say the data is insufficient to really say whether there's any validity or acceptability of the definitions. And I think they cited a couple of abstracts, but I didn't see any real defined papers. And, you know, VAP has a history of being problematic to start with, and now this, I think, is sort of an alternative to VAP. So maybe it's better than the VAP, but still, when I looked at the definitions, they were pretty complicated. And so I did have, I mean, I think, you know, I had some concerns about sort of how where we should go with this, because I guess when you go into the validity piece, they actually talk about the fact that there is not a lot of there's really not much information here to say that the way they measure it, or the new the VAC measure or concept is valid or not.
Okay.
So, I mean, in their own description, they weren't really describing this as being yet a valid definition and system of measurement. And so I sort of had some concerns about pushing this forward, since it does have a history of VAP, you know, which has been a problem in the past, just definition-wise. And I think NQF had approved the VAP concept before. It's run into a lot of problems with reliability of the definitions and et cetera, and the radiograph identification of an infection. So this is, I think, an improvement over the original definition, but yet they still don't say that it's a valid definition and process yet. And there have been some, you know, they did cite some abstracts, and they did talk a lot about VAP, which has been a problem. They talk about it being a problem. So if the concept is this is a brand new thing and VAP didn't exist and VAP hadn't been such a problem, it'd be much harder to say this should move forward. If this is to replace VAP, which has historically been a problem, and hopefully this will be better, then maybe this is a better process, and maybe, you know, we probably should at least consider moving forward on it. So if it's going to replace the current VAP, which has caused chaos in the system, this might be an alternative improvement, but it's still not, at least according to their description, it's still not ready for, it doesn't seem like it's ready for prime time yet.
Okay. Shelley, you're on the line.
I wasn't a reviewer of this, but I just thought I would, you know, kind of give you my...
Yeah, no, okay. You know, anybody else on the work group comments?
Well,
we do have Shelley from CDC who can respond to some of her...
So this is Mitchell, and I guess...
Oh, great. Welcome.
So I need to do a full disclosure, because I was part of the work group, and Shelley's going to talk about it in a second, that developed these measures. So this was, and then I'll let Shelley speak as well, but there's clearly an enormous amount of problem, or really honestly a lack of definition of VAP up until now. And NHSN has been using a kind of very rudimentary and weak definition, and everybody in the field's in agreement about that, and therefore we've never been able to surveil the true incidence of VAP, because the definition's never been agreed upon. And over the last 2 years...
I can't hear very well. Can the person speak up a little?
Over the last 2 years, are you still having trouble hearing?
That's better.
So over the last 2 years, there's been a drive by Don Wright and from HHS and others to convene a consensus group to build new definitions, and that's what you see here is the results of that document, with the understanding that none of this has really been tested formally yet, but in just some attempt to produce some measures that we felt would give us a chance to do a better surveillance of ventilator-associated conditions. Shelley?
Can I ask a question? Do you mind if I'm sorry to interrupt. It's David Stockwell. So I have a question for the folks at the NQF. I have the exact same concerns that were stated previously. I certainly applaud the effort to get to a more workable VAP definition and look forward to throwing the old one entirely out the window. That's terrific. But for the NQF purposes, as I looked through the evaluation criteria and guidance summary tables, the major gap here seems to be that it's never been field tested. And so is the NQF interested in encouraging the use of a non-tested measure? And if so, that seems to be appropriate. But that's not how I read the evaluation criteria for looking at all of these items.
Right. And, David, you're absolutely right. No, we're not. There are some very rare circumstances at this point that NQF would consider them, but that doesn't seem to apply into this circumstance. I guess one of the questions I had, and I know I've talked with Shelley about this before, is, you know, the kind of reference or allusion to unpublished or preliminary data, you know, sort of indicates that CDC is moving ahead with this measure, because they are at least getting some good feedback, or getting feedback from preliminary study that that this is going to work out certainly better than the old VAP measure. And if some of that even data were available, would that be more, would that make the committee feel more comfortable about it?
Well, it would for me. I mean, if we are here to base the appropriateness of a measure to be endorsed by the NQF by the current evaluation criteria, then we must have that,
right,
as I read this. And look, I would love to see this go and work, and I think the only thing from my perspective that needs to be added are some exclusions that weren't in the document that I saw. Maybe I missed them, but I would love to see this move ahead, but as I see it laid out in the evaluation criteria, we just don't have the ability to approve it as it stands right now.
And then, yeah, this is Peter again. I'm glad at least somebody agreed with me. If you look at the definitions on page 10 and 11, they're also pretty interesting to try to follow that, because it's sort of an algorithm of how to determine and not to determine. And, you know, based on we have problems with people just doing very simple measures, this becomes an even more challenging concept to try to even see whether we can even do this in the field as a measure. I think we can do it as a research project, but I don't know whether it can be done as an applied measure throughout the country. The other problem for us is we already report VAP throughout the country in all of our hospitals, and we put it on a public website. And so I know what's going to happen is that if we do approve it, we'll switch the criteria and we'll be publicly reporting this data. And it's not been field tested. So that's just some of my concerns. I think it would be good if we had sort of like the in between, like the preliminary measure versus the actual final measure that people might actually go and do. So, I agree with the person who just spoke in that, you know, I think it's a great attempt to get it forward. We really need to do something about VAP, but it's not going to be field tested. And, you know, maybe the NQF has to have another criteria of acceptance, sort of a preliminary acceptance, something that, you know, we don't want the field to think it's not good. We want them to think that maybe this is the way to go, so we don't want to give the field the wrong message, but we also don't want to give the field something that has not been tested well.
Okay. Shelley, did you want to comment?
Sure. Thank you for all of your comments and thoughts and careful review of this. I mean, we certainly appreciate it. And, we have been thinking about this and working on this for quite a while now. And, you know, definitely your concerns are shared and have been shared by us at CDC and by our working group members, as Mitchell mentioned. So this was a consensus process with the working group members. We had struggled with how to modify this definition for a while to make it more reliable, as you're all very familiar with. The current pneumonia definitions are very, very complex and have many subjective elements that just make them unworkable in today's environment. And so we convened this working group to develop this algorithm, you know, really with the intent of getting a lot of input from all of the stakeholder communities, including critical care. And the algorithm that you see is you know, what the group felt was the best direction to go, and kind of acknowledging that, there just simply isn't a gold standard definition for pneumonia, for VAP in particular, today. And so, you know, the NHSN definitions that exist right now are not good, but they're, you know, arguably not worse than anything else that we might choose to use that's out there for VAP right now. So, you know, we did want to focus on reliability. We thought from a prevention standpoint, it was also important to kind of emphasize conditions or complications that occur in the ventilated patient as a whole, as opposed to perhaps focusing on a specific entity that's not easily diagnosed. And I think that, you know, there is some experience, not necessarily with the identical algorithm that you see, but if you're familiar with some of there is actually a plus one paper that's cited in there by Dr. Mike Klompas at Brigham and Women's and the CDC EpiCenters. And the abstracts you see, there is some experience with variations on the theme of this definition. So There is work that's been done and published looking at kind of the foundational elements of the definition, which is that change in oxygenation or worsening oxygenation after a period of stability or improvement. And in addition to that plus one paper, there's a paper that was just published after the submission in Clinical Infectious Diseases. And, you know, although there are elements of the algorithm that are different from what appears in those papers, I think there's every reason to expect that that they would perform similarly because, again, the key piece of it really is that kind of respiratory deterioration piece. There is a little information about inter-rater reliability in that recently published CID article. And in work that appears in that plus one paper, as well as in the abstracts, a streamlined VAP definition that, again, includes the foundational elements that are in this VAC and IVAC algorithm, patients meeting those criteria did have worse outcomes than patients who didn't meet the criteria in terms of length of stay, duration of mechanical ventilation, and even mortality. So I think there is good reason to expect that this will perform well in kind of a real-world setting. The epicenters are doing work right now to look at some of these issues more closely related to preventability and the reliability issue. But you're right. We are in need of additional experience with it. That's just the reality that we're dealing with. So I don't know if that's helpful at all, but again, I certainly appreciate your comments and concerns about this.
Shelley, this is Reva. What do you think your timeline is for having some data on this to be able to respond to some of these concerns?
I would anticipate that probably within the next year. As I mentioned, we are moving forward with implementing this in NHSN for 2013. There are a number of things that need to happen to make that to get this deployed. So we are, moving in that direction currently. But as I mentioned, there is the epicenter's work that's ongoing, and I do think that we will have some data hopefully within the next 12 months or so.
Okay. Because I'm just trying to think perhaps trying to look at this now might be premature, because I certainly get a sense from the work group that that you would be very interested in an improved measure to replace the old one. But you really can't evaluate it now without data, and perhaps we can work out something to look at this maybe in 12 months when we do have data that is can respond to the various questions and criteria, and it just may be premature at this time. Thoughts from the work group?
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, who was talking?
It's Mitchell. So it's a catch-22. I totally agree that it's too soon to accept measures that really haven't been subjected to reliability and validity testing. I also feel that part of the reason why we needed these measures is the current measure is truly unreliable and not valid, which is why, fortunately, CMS has never used it as a pay-for-performance because the agreement is the definition is just inadequate. So it does sound like it's appropriate to wait. Part of the impetus for this happening and it being submitted is the sense that CMS might move ahead with the inadequate definition of VAP that's already being reported and make it a pay for performance. And so there is some feeling that this current set is better than the one that has been previously used, but I can understand the reticence of the group not to want to push something forward that doesn't meet the criteria that we're being asked to apply to all the other measures.
Right. This is Reva. Shelley, I just want to verify, but CDC has basically pulled out the old VAP measure, saying that this is the planned replacement. So NQF's course with that is that measure is going to lose its endorsement from us during the course of this project, regardless of whether this one actually goes forward at this time.
That's the best thing I've heard all day.
Okay. I mean, right. Shelley, you're right. I mean, CDC has said Yeah, that they're retiring it. So it's on our retired list. You're going to find when we give you the documents for the meeting that there are, I can't remember how many, 8 or 10 measures that aren't that had been previously endorsed that for a whole variety of reasons, the developers are not pursuing them for continued endorsement, and the old VAP measure is on that list. So it will lose its endorsement during the course of this project. So it does. So the two are not inextricably tied together. So we can lose the old VAP measure and maybe wait a while before replacing it with the new one when we get more data.
And this is, Peter, I think that's good. If we can, if it could be retired, maybe we just need to have a honeymoon period. The concern is if we do agree to move this measure forward, and then next year we find there are more problems with it.
Right.
And then we have to make more modifications. This is going to be a measure that will never live to see the light of day again.
Yeah.
Because
right.
You can't just keep saying, we didn't get it right, we're going to do it again.
Sure.
So, I'm not sure how the sponsor feels, but if they think within a year it's going to be ready, it might be good just to get everyone to stop thinking about VAP and their distaste for it. And then, when the data comes in that this is really what we're going to do, then we go ahead and review it and hopefully approve it, and then it goes into the system. If we approve it now and it's got problems again, everyone's going to see it's had problems before, it's got problems again, this is never going to be right. And that's just some of my concern. But the other concern was that somebody brought up it's a catch-22, and I think you resolved that by saying we'll retire the other one anyway. And so maybe there'll just be a small period of time where we won't have one until this one is ready to go, and then we'll put this in, then this would go into the system for use.
Because one of the things we can do in the report out is to indicate that there is support for an improved measure, and it's just not ready yet, and when it is, we're looking forward to evaluating it after we've got some testing data and some experience with the measure.
And I think if you add to that acknowledgement that the old measure is being retired, it then becomes a very powerful statement.
Okay.
Can I offer one thing that I didn't note in the definition, and maybe I missed it, but there are several reasons for potentially having an increased oxygen requirement, and it may be that you have a catheter-associated bloodstream infection that's caused you to have ARDS. You may have a stroke and get ARDS as a result of that. I would think about adding in some exclusions so that hospitals aren't double counting a BSI and a ventilator associated complication, and just make it very, very clear for the users what's going to end up in what column so that it can be as workable as possible.
But if you look at the definitions, it looked like fluid overload would trigger this every time.
And this is Shelley, and Mitchell can certainly comment as well. But with this new algorithm, we are recognizing that, even with the current definitions, or perhaps particularly with the current definitions, we are not accurately identifying VAP. We are identifying lots of other things, too, including CHF, including ARDS, including lots of other things. So this algorithm is not, intended to be specifically identifying patients with VAP. We know we're going to get patients with other conditions and complications, and again, the thought is that if they have that period of stability or improvement, and then they get worse, there has been potentially a complication of care, and that we would be interested in capturing that from a prevention standpoint. So, you're absolutely right. There are, a patient can be septic and have a decline in oxygenation as a result of that, not necessarily related to primary infection of the respiratory tract, and we will capture.
And I didn't see that algorithm, I didn't see the flowchart of how the sepsis-related increase in oxygen requirement would be removed from this category.
It won't be removed.
Okay. Now,
there are rules within NHSN around secondary bloodstream infections and whether a bloodstream infection is secondary or primary. And there will be operational guidance about when a user can check that secondary bloodstream infection box for this algorithm. But you're right, there will be circumstances like that that will trigger the VAC or IVAC definition or determination and could
but
potentially.
I guess, well, my hesitancy with that is that if you have an increased oxygen requirement as a result of sepsis for one reason or another, is that ventilator associated? I mean, we have to, the clinicians have to sort of buy into the concept. And so if I how is sepsis ventilator associated?
It's a process that has occurred in a patient who's being mechanically ventilated after a period of stability on the ventilator. So it's not necessarily, you know, we're not, I guess, making statements about the ultimate kind of causality of that, but it is a complication that occurred in a patient who's mechanically ventilated. And to the extent that we can learn about what those things are and how to prevent them, you know, this, I think, is a useful approach. Again, because, you know, with the VAP definitions now, we're also capturing some of those patients. I mean, the universe of patients who have a pneumonia or VAP event right now includes lots of patients who don't actually have VAP. And we're missing a lot of patients who actually do have VAP.
And I think the other important thing that I think is there's no question this has gotten more vague. At the same time, the specificity of the previous includes anybody who gets an infiltrate within the first 24 hours of admission. So we've done away with that. We've stopped the measure that actually gives a hospital gets dinged for a ventilator-associated pneumonia in a patient who comes in and was found down on the outside. So that's a huge step forward. So there's definitely a kind of balance between getting a little more vague and a lot of concerns about that, and at the same time getting more rigorous so that there's clearly a period of stability of a patient on a ventilator before a condition develops, before you can call it a ventilator-associated condition.
I guess I would just consider maybe changing the language, because some of these things we're talking about aren't associated with a ventilator. And look, I'm a pediatric intensivist, and we don't even sniff that VAP definition because it's inapplicable to our patients. And so that's great, and I'm glad that this is moving forward. But I guess if we're going to call something ventilator associated condition, I think that the clinicians out there, for them to buy into it, harking back to what Peter was saying earlier, it should be ventilator associated. Or the name should change.
All right. I think we're going to have to move on to discussion of the other measures. And I thank the Mitchell and Shelley for being part of that conversation. So I think the next measure we'd like to talk about is 334, which is PICU severity adjusted length of stay. And Dr. Stockwell, I think this was one you were leading. And in general, if we look across the ratings from the three folks who submitted their ratings, generally it seems to be rated quite well and high. And but any comments, please?
It's David. I guess I'll start it off. I think that I was fairly comfortable with this. This is sort of a known approach to measuring pediatric ICU length of stay with a very well-validated measure using PRISM 3. So I think that the experience of using it is out there, and as I recall, I don't think I had a lot of problems with it.
Okay. The one thing I would just mention in looking at the submission information is there really wasn't much entered under reliability testing, yet further down on page 9, they talk about that these data elements are numerators, denominators, and all definitions are standardized with an inter-rater reliability of greater than 96%. And so it just isn't necessarily inserted right in the best place for it. I had one question, just for clarification, in terms of specification. It's actually a subtraction of dates, or are we looking at hours? When you're talking about,
I've always thought this was dates, but I don't know. Is there really somebody from VPS on the call?
Yeah.
Maybe they can answer.
Christine Gall should be on the call. If she's in the public line, operator, can you open her?
Sure. Ms. Gall, your line is open.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, now we can. Thank
Hello?
You.
Oh, hi. Yeah. Hi, everybody. Actually, the way VPS calculates the length of stay is we go down to the minute and then roll it back up to the hour because we collect both date and time of ICU admission and discharge. So that is how we use that tool, and that's consistent with how it was developed.
Okay. Are there any other comments? Because I think generally everyone felt it met the importance criteria, met the scientific acceptability criteria.
Well, Peter, I just one thing. You know, we do a risk-adjusted length of stay also, and we found, at least in the ICU, what was happening was people were physically, on paper, moved to another location, yet they were physically still in a location. So it was very easy to game the measure. And that's why we sort of went to a hospital length of stay. We do an ICU one, but we also do a whole hospital length of stay, which includes the ICU stay because of the gaming. And we do it all electronically, but they can still game it because electronically they'll basically still physically be in the unit, but they're on paper, they're still somewhere else because they haven't been moved yet. So just as an FYI, I mean, the measure's okay. I'm just telling you that it's easily to game. You can game this pretty easily.
All right. One other question I just wanted to clarify, Christine, is on the specifications, when you talk about the risk model, you talk about selection criteria for risk adjustment tool, and then you talk about the PRISM 3 meeting those criteria, but is the specification for this measure to use the PRISM 3 model for absolutely no others?
Yes. This tool spec requires PRISM 3.
Great. Okay. I don't know. At least my reading of it, I wasn't totally clear, and it's good to verify that. Are there updates to PRISM 3 that are done regularly?
Our analytic team is in the process of doing updates. We had intended to do it very frequently. However, we transitioned our application from one desktop module to a web-based module, and that absorbed a little more resource than we had intended. So we're now back on track, and we have our analytic team ready to focus on this. We now have data in the web-based model approaching 200,000 records, so we feel confident that we can revalidate the tool and then we plan to do that at least, I think the plan is annually.
All right. And
were you planning on doing an acute care risk-adjusted length of stay?
Acute care? Not
yeah.
In our immediate future. However, we're thinking about approaching first the intermediate level of patients. I appreciated the comments earlier about gaming or gamesmanship, whether intentional or not. You know, we have challenges to length of stay that relate basically to the structure of the institution. For example, intermediate care. If there's a separate intermediate care unit within an organization, just that structural element alone can impact the comparative length of stay. So we want to go to that level and possibly acute care. We're looking at other surgical and trauma type populations as well. So my based upon the previous conversations I've had with my team, I think that is definitely possible in the future.
And in the acute care, I mean, it does include the ICU and the wards, so
mm-hmm.
it's both together.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be too hard to build one just for the wards because the death rates tend to be too low.
Right.
Just to catch people up about what VPS does, VPS is only a group of intensive care units. As I understand it, you guys haven't expanded out beyond that.
Currently, we are critical, yes. Pediatric intensive care, yes. We have currently 118 ICUs participating.
Do you know if this measure is used by hospitals that are not VPS participants?
The risk-adjusted length of stay?
Yeah, or any of these measures, but yeah, particularly the risk-adjusted ones.
I think to participate with PRISM, it's a proprietary risk adjustment model. You have to participate with VPS. Isn't that correct?
Currently, yes.
Okay, so PRISM is not available to anyone else unless you participate in VPS. Okay. I mean, I think that's a usability issue. Okay. Any other comments, thoughts, concerns by the from the work group members on this measure? But it looks like you generally feel comfortable with it and have rated it as meeting the criteria. All right, then let's move on to measure 335, which is the PICU unplanned readmission rate. Who is the discussant here? My list says Dr. Levy. Have you had a chance to look at this, Dr. Levy?
No, I haven't, unfortunately, okay. So I'm not prepared to do that. I have been traveling extensively for 2 weeks. Sorry about that.
All right. Thanks for being here today, then. If you look at the spreadsheet, I think that there are a couple of questions raised by David and maybe a little bit from Peter in terms of the criteria for importance. High impact seems to be there. Opportunity for improvement, David, you weren't so sure about that. Readmissions are typically felt to be more of an outcome than a process measure, so the evidence doesn't have to be quite the same level for process measures, but I think you had some concerns about this one. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that, David?
I guess, yeah, and it's based in two things. One, if I recall correctly, I don't remember a lot of evidence to support that this measure is something that does have real impact, and that combined with our own experience, we've been tracking 24-hour readmissions for about 3 years, and for most of the time in the PICU, it's either seizure patients or often bronchiolytic patients that just change ever so slightly, and there doesn't seem to be any area for opportunity for improvement that we've noted. So I guess I'm biased a little bit by our local experience, but I certainly support the idea of reviewing these readmissions as something that any ICU should do as an outcome of their care. It's just we've been doing it, and I'm not sure it's changed a whole lot of what we've been doing.
Does VPS have any trend data for this to see if your participating hospitals are changing their performance?
Actually, yes. We do track comparatively every participating center. And, you know, we've had experiences that run the gamut from not much change to some pretty obvious changes. The comment earlier, I don't know who made it, is accurate that there's definitely a low occurrence of unplanned, unscheduled readmissions within 24 hours to the PICU. So it makes determination usefulness of the measure in itself sometimes challenging. However, what we've seen over time is we have seen some cyclic patterns that tend to be influenced when the entire hospital is full, and then decisions to transfer or discharge a patient earlier than would have been preferred has occurred. We also, related to the other measure of the evaluation of the unplanned readmission, with the ability to categorize contributing factors in the areas of, you know, was it a systemic factor? Was it an issue that the hospital was full or there wasn't an ICU bed? Was there an issue related to the receiving unit that they may not have had the competencies that this particular patient or the staffing ratios to support the care and the observation that that patient needed? Was there perhaps a decision that was determined in the course of the review to be maybe incomplete in deciding to transfer a patient out? So I think as we get more experience with these two measures together, we definitely have opportunities, I think, to learn because, you know, while one center may have low numbers aggregately, we have the ability to really look at factors that seem to be influential, you know, overall, and then factors that seem to be influential, you know, given a set of circumstances, like the ratio of acute care beds to critical care beds seems to be a factor that has influenced this. So definitely we're looking at trends.
I think that's very interesting points that you bring up. Has any of that been published? Because I don't see it in the application.
Not yet.
Well,
not yet.
I mean, if there's some way we could get a summary of some of that to include, I think that's very informative to really explain sort of the big picture on the use of this measure. So perhaps
okay.
we can work with you to try and get some of that information included in the measure information.
Okay, sure. Katie, should I work with you offline on that?
Yes, we'll do that.
Okay.
David.
Can I ask a question? I struggled a little bit with the difference between 335 and 336,
mm-hmm.
and wonder, is this an opportunity to harmonize, I believe is the term that you guys like to use? and if we could we talk about what the difference between these two things are and what the intent
sure.
of the difference are?
Sure. 336. Peter, was this the measure you were reviewing?
I was wondering maybe if Christine wouldn't mind tackling it.
Sure.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't want to speak out of turn. So I think that as a benchmark or as a starting place, having an understanding of the rates, the raw rates, the unplanned readmission rates is really an important start. From that evaluation, you can see things like seasonal trends. You can look at whether or not there seem to be patterns related to staffing changes. For example, did you get, if in July when the new group of residents or fellows comes in, do you see any decision making? For another example is, how do you staff your unit? Do you have 24/7 in-house attending coverage, or alternatively, do you rely on fellows to run off shifts with attending support via phone and in person as necessary? So I think that based upon looking at the rates themselves, you can come up with questions that are important to ask. And then I think I agree, the 336 is complementary to that. Once the questions are asked, how do you systematically evaluate factors that might have contributed to a potential pattern you might be seeing? And that's where the documentation and the categorization of pretty infrequent events over time hopefully, you know, helps to inform those questions. So I see that there could be an opportunity to harmonize, although I do think that each of these measures kind of looks at the question from a different level. Does that help?
Do we want to just look at the details to 336 so we know what we're talking about?
Was that to me?
Well, I guess I had the question because when I read the numerator-denominator description of the measure, I have to admit I was a little bit confused as to exactly how this 336 works, which is review of unplanned PICU readmissions.
Mm-hmm.
And described as periodic clinical review of unplanned readmissions to the PICU that occurred within 24 hours of discharge or transfer. Is that a yes or no answer? Is it a percentage of something?
Yes or no, did it occur? But then there's a categorization of the contributing factors to that review. So was were there the contributing factors related to the receiving unit? Was it determined that the transfer back was truly not clinically indicated, but, for example, the resources on the receiving unit were either insufficient or not of the appropriate competency to manage that patient's non-critical issues? That's one example. So there's various categories that allow you to basically code contributing factors that can, over time, be aggregated.
Members of the work group, what are your thoughts on measure 336, the review of the unplanned readmissions? David, your ratings are on the low side.
I didn't understand it because I had a little bit of the same concern that you expressed about what does this actually mean. I feel like if I took this to our staff and said, okay, we want to implement this measure now, I couldn't explain it to them. And that may be my problem. I'm certainly willing to admit that. But the I guess one of the assumptions is that 335 is just a straight rate. But I guess where I'm stumbling is with the language of unplanned. Unplanned seems to me to be some kind of clinical determination, meaning therefore someone has reviewed it. And so if you are just taking all readmissions within 24 hours and calling that a rate, and that's 335, then that makes sense. And then 336 is actually to do a clinical review of those readmissions within 24 hours. Then that makes sense, but that's not what I read between the two. And if somebody could just clarify that for me, it'd be great.
I can clarify the definition of unplanned, and I'll do that by contrasting a planned readmission to the unit. Let's say somebody has cyclical surgical interventions or procedures that following that procedure, they need a period of recovery or monitoring in the ICU. And that occurs with some frequency. We differentiate between that type of planned upgrading care from something that was not previously planned. And that's the difference between unplanned and planned readmissions. We really want to focus on those that were not, the upgrading care was not anticipated or intended.
But doesn't that require a clinical review? And if so, then how is that different than 336?
Well, so the coding of planned versus unplanned has definitions in itself, and that is that the team was aware that the patient was going to arrive to the unit within 24 hours. So, for example, you know that this patient who you just transferred out to the acute care intermediate floor tomorrow is on the surgical schedule for whatever, and you know that postoperatively that patient is going to come back to you, that would be considered planned. So it's in the collection of the data, so to speak.
Well, maybe the other part of my problem is that we're a VPS client, and is this something that all of your clients are participating in? Because when I spoke with our reviewers, we are not asked to determine whether or not readmissions within 24 hours are planned or unplanned, as I understand, as I was told by our guys.
Actually, that's not exactly accurate. Every admission that your data collection team enters, there's a field that requires them to say scheduled or unscheduled according to the definition. The calculation of unplanned readmission, though, is made on our end. It's behind the scenes. There's no additional data collection that needs to happen. We just know that within the, we will track patients from the time that they left the unit till the time they came back, and if they fall within that 24-hour threshold, we then look at the additional field of scheduled or unscheduled in order to calculate this rate, with, you know, that being the numerator. So it is something that is based upon the data collection that the data collectors do that we then calculate.
Okay, so that's helpful. So now let's go to 336. 336 means mm-hmm. that of those that are unplanned, this measure is looking somehow for additional factors, and you don't have to go into them again. I completely understand what could lead to those factors, but
right.
that the individual ICU should go back and review those, and I didn't
right.
understand. Does that mean that this is a sample, or it's complete comprehensive review?
It is the module is available in VPS, and it's totally voluntary. So for the teams that choose to collect, they can choose to collect these data. So typically the teams will review this at a monthly M&M or whatever. There is then a module that they can go in where all of the unplanned readmissions have been populated, and they can then click off the, you know, the results of their review. So was the reason for readmission, deterioration, patient condition related to the initial diagnosis or a new diagnosis? So there's a series of reasons that can be documented over time. So it's not a required or mandatory field in VPS. It's something that's totally available if centers want to use it. And then there's an on-demand report that they can print off as needed. So that's how it works.
That was kind of my confusion also is, I mean, if you're going to do 335, why would you not do 336? Why isn't it not one measure? I'm kind of wondering why you would review a hospital, look at the unplanned readmissions within 24 hours, calculate it, get a number, and not pay any attention to it. That just seems...
Well, I guess so. If
we had to do 24-hour reviews, I thought it was usually
right.
a Joint Commission piece.
Right.
So
there's some teams that don't have any issues. They have no unplanned readmissions, so I guess the rate is the baseline to see if there's an issue, and then the review of any unplanned readmissions occurs when an issue is identified.
This is Reva. I'm still struggling to really understand how this functions as a performance measure, because on page 6 on 336 under the calculation algorithm, it says there is no better score. I mean, what does a score on this measure look like, and can it be used to compare one hospital to another?
I think that this measure, the unplanned rate 335, is definitely something that you could look to do a comparison between organizations. But the factors that influence that rate, I think, is it appropriate to compare them? I think we need a little bit more information. We need more documentation to determine, you know, are there, if a ratio of acute care to critical care beds, for example, falls below X, or if the average tenure of the nursing staff on the intermediate unit is below X years, that those seem to be triggers that might increase this rate. I mean, there are things that this could contribute to the body of knowledge, and I think how hospitals decide to structure and manage their...
The way I kind of read this was if in 335, let's say you have a 10% readmission rate within 24 hours to the unit, the measure 336 would say... Of the 10% that got readmitted, 50 or 75% of them were reviewed. I mean, that's what it looks like. You know, had a clinical review of the case.
Yeah, that's why I'm...
You should get a percentage for both.
Yes, there's a review rate, and then there is an assessment of the appropriateness of the initial transfer out of the unit, the appropriateness of the receiving unit, and then the appropriateness of the transfer back to the unit, as well as contributing factors for the readmission. You know what it might help is I could send a screenshot of how we document this if you'd like. And that might help understand.
I just think it needs to be, the definition needs to be the numerator statement, the denominator statement. To me, I can't tell the difference between those two things. I think you're hearing some confusion from some of the other people. I think that the worksheet needs to perhaps go back and think about how to better define exactly what the measure is.
Okay.
Also, can you give us some examples, since it's in use, of what the results are? I mean, you know, you've given us the unplanned readmission rate range of, what is it, 0 to 3.14. I get that. That makes sense. I'm looking for the similar data for 336.